It is good to review, and in that sense, I listen to myself. I listen to, because there's so much packed into not such a tremendous amount of time, and the situations repeat themselves and figuring things. And I'll be totally upfront again. I did not in any way present the entirety of the love and logic approach. We just did a little bit of it. If you find it successful, or you want to go over it, read the book, or listen to this Becky Udman that I sent you out. She gives a wonderful presentation. As your children get older, it changes a lot. Just for example, we never really address like what happens when your kids come home. Most of your children aren't old enough for this yet. They come home and they forgot their homework at school. So love and logic is, that's great. You feel, oh, it's total empathy. I feel so bad. And then you just give it to them, like, what are we going to do about this? And they're going to say, well, you're going to have to go and get my book.
You said today you just go on the internet again. So.
Right. Whatever the situation might be. Yeah. Well, my schedule is set. I don't have time to go back and get your book. And then they'll have to come up with either dealing with it or calling up their friend. Let them be creative, but it's totally shifting who's responsible as they get older. There's this concept called going brain dead in love and logic, which is just as a terminology, which means that when you get into arguments with your kids, you basically just go brain dead. But I really want this, and whatever the response is, like, you can't have it, or not now, or later, I really want to go, I know, but you didn't do this, and they just go over, you just go brain dead. The argument basically goes, I know, but I'm the only one who's not going to have it, I know, but I really want to go, I know, but you're the worst parents in the world, I know, and it's just like, I'm not engaging this argument, because it's been discovered and discussed, whatever it's going to be, and at that point, there's no more discussion. I know, that's really, I know. Or I love you too much to argue. They're like certain phrases that you just say over and over again until your kids go, pah! That's good. But then they give up and they stop because they know there's no slot machine at the end. There's no point that they're ever going to get anywhere and you're just consistent. There's a lot more to it. If you've enjoyed it, if you found it successful, listen to them again, get it into your head, practice it, do it, read the books. Let me just conclude the love and logic with just one last thing, which I heard from Becky Udman on one of her tapes that I just wanted to share. I think is so valuable when she was discussing the scene in the restaurant or in the supermarket in the checkout line, and one of the kids wigs out, and you know that everybody's looking at you and your kids, and you're going to be consistent with whatever you're going to do, and no matter what they're going to throw at you, you're not going to give in to whatever it is that they want, and you're sure that everybody's looking at you. And she says, remember during those moments that you have more invested in your child than you have in what anybody else is thinking about you at that time. And it's hard to remember in those moments, but what your investment is what's in front of you. This is where your greatest investment is, and if you have an approach, if you have a way that you're going to handle it, I don't care what anybody else thinks, whether or not it's your parents, or worse, your in-laws, or your sister-in-law, about what they're going to think about your parenting skills. If this is the approach, you have more invested in that bundle of joy who's pitching a fit right now than you're doing anything else in the world. And you keep that in mind and you allow that to weigh how you're going to behave in those circumstances, because that's really where your investment lies. Okay. So tonight, we'll see if we can get it all in. We'll get it all in. If not, we'll do it one more, whatever works. It's based on these two books. If you've heard of them, if you read them, they're fantastic. This one is by Chaim. I don't know if it's Gino or Ginat. I don't know. It depends on probably where you're from, how you pronounce it. Jewish guy from Eretz Yisrael, came to America. Child psychologist, wrote a book between parent and child, in which he was the first to revolutionize the communications between children and parents. And then he had two Talmidot, Faber and Mazlish, who basically updated his work into how to talk to kids will listen and listen to kids will talk. If you haven't heard of these or read them, talking about investments in your children, these are worthwhile investments to buy and to read and to reread and read a third time. This is what I'm going to base almost everything that we'll say tonight is based on one of these two books. They are well worth the investment in your time and energy. And again, I'm not going to cover all of them, obviously, but just some highlights that I have found particularly fun and exciting to use. Tonight's stuff, as much as love and logic is a great tool, as I mentioned, it's really a tool. It's a reaction to stuff that our kids throw our way. It's a great tool. It's helpful. I find it very effective. What we'll do tonight is much more of a proactive how to create the tone and environment of our home, how to talk to our children, the things that we do and don't do so well, and learn a series of tools to use them. Because we know, at the end of the day, the words we use with our children are the most powerful tools that we have. Most of us grew up with one of the greatest lies that American society has given us, of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. That is horrible. It is, as we've experienced, it's one of the biggest lies that we have as children. Words will hurt far more than sticks and stones. Sticks and stones, a bone will heal. The words we hear, they sometimes will last a lifetime. A mean word, a person who says you can't do something, you'll never amount to anything, they're daggers. And we know what a positive word can do. It can totally change your life in terms of, I didn't think I was able to do this. And somebody came over to me and said, you're a great writer. And it's like one comment, and all of a sudden a person's whole career takes a different path. Very, very powerful. And the way that we use our words with our children is so, so powerful. And so we'll, it's basically their entire approach is based on that, how we interact, the words we use, how we speak, and how we listen to them. See, I'm so hesitant to give these out because, like, once you hand out papers, it's everybody's lost. Everybody's flipping through. So I'm going to hold off. Okay. Tool number one that I want to discuss is the concept of praise. Praise is, you know, that which we really want to do. We want to build up our children. We want them to know that we feel proud of them. We feel good about them. And it's a tricky thing. So I sent out a homework assignment. I don't know if everybody paid attention to it. To count and pay attention to your interactions in your home, what the ratio is of positive to less than positive interactions. So that if you sort of wake up and you're like, get out of bed, get dressed, you spilled your breakfast, clean this up. It's a lot of commands, a lot of corrections, a lot of frustration. And hopefully Love and Logic addressed some of that. But if you paid attention, it's still, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of what we would call almost negativity or things that from our children's perspective wouldn't be warm and fun. Anyone take any guesses? It's like just estimating what it was. Was it 50-50? Was it worse than 50-50?
I was more aware of when I was saying, well, I need you to get in the car now. Or I found myself doing a lot of, I need you to do this now.
Trying
and
to make
then,
it less.
Well, that was how I was playing. And then I went, wait a second. Would you like to get in the car by yourself? Or would you like, a, you know, like, but I was more aware of it once you set that out.
So if you just listen to people, if you go into their home and just listen, you'll hear that the preponderance of interactions are not positive. It's just a constant a stream of commands and corrections and do this and don't do that and pick this up and we got to go. And from a child's perspective, it's not really a lot of warm fuzzies coming from us parents, part of which is because we're always stressed out and late and trying to deal with stuff. But that's part of the thing. Let me just throw in parenthetically one more thing to remember. This is just totally on the side, but just an important note. Everyone's familiar when you get in the airplane. They give you the whole spiel, which everyone knows by heart already, but they always tell you that in case of a sudden loss of air pressure, from above your seat will drop your air mask. And everybody knows, what do they say to do with it first? Always put on yourself and then put on your children. And why is that? Because if you go unconscious, there's nobody left to take care of your children. So for the extra 5 seconds that your kids are without air, they'll be fine. Go take care of yourself. You're the adult. You need to make sure that you're in a position to help. And when you're okay, you'll be able and in a position to tend to your children. It's obvious everybody knows. We're like, we probably would have thought it. I wonder if we would have or would not have intuited that. We probably would not have. But now that it's been so ingrained in us, we know that that's true. I have often used this when it comes to our parenting. Don't forget that lesson. If you come home from a Sunday afternoon outing and everybody is just slammed, late, you got to get supper on the table, and you're exhausted, and they're exhausted, you're hungry, you have to go to the bathroom, and the kids don't want to sit down and eat dinner yet, and you don't have the energy to chase them around because you're starving and you haven't gone to the bathroom in 4 hours, let them play, and everyone will go to bed a half hour later. If you need to sit down and eat by yourself, that's fine. And sometimes I say, like, we need to like remind us, like, I've often done that, like, if I'm in charge of the dinner time, and I get back from shul, and I'm also starving, I'm not in any position to love and logic or speak nicely or calmly with the kid. I can't because I'm drained. So I will often let them, I won't even say the dinner, like let them play wherever they're doing. They're outside, they're in the playroom, sit down by myself, have a nice quiet meal, and then it's okay, I'm ready to handle dinner time. I'm ready to handle bath time. Because if we're not in a position ourselves, we're going to, you know, we know what it's like. So when we try parenting, when we're, now, sometimes I wish I had a way to go to sleep for an hour, but I don't have that magic pill. But if it means just at least eating or going to the bathroom, like, just don't forget to take care of yourself before you handle the kids. Okay, just a sidebar. Okay, so I read in one of these, not one of these books, in some other book, the 80-20 rule. So the 80-20 rule, or I've seen in subsequently in a bunch of other different books, similar numbers, between the amount of positive interactions and any interaction which your child would not necessarily assume is positive. Which way do you think that goes, the 80 and the 20? And so it's 80 positive. So when I first read that, I said, well, that's obvious. Like, everyone can do that. And I started paying attention myself, and it was not even close where I could say that 4 out of every 5 interactions with my child would be par, forget about positive. I wasn't even hitting, you know, there's like positive, parv, and like negative. I wasn't even hitting 4 out of 5 in parv and positive. They were just, it's an amazing thing. As we have children, we constantly need things being done, and we are constantly commanding and demanding of them. So, set to work on this. So what we want to work on, so tool number one is going to be working on this concept of praise. So of the 80%, so this book that I had read, divided it half and half, 4 out of the 8 should be statements of unconditional love, and 4 out of the 5 should be statements of conditional love. So 4 out of 8 out of 10, 4, however you want to break it down, whatever the numbers are. Half of your positive comments being conditional love and half being unconditional. What was the reasoning behind that? So, again, I forgot who the author was. Reason, which is a fairly reasonable thing. We don't have to have the numbers exact. But if all your statements directed to your children are unconditional love, you're not giving them a sense that there's any expectation, that there's any noting of what they're doing that's right, that's wrong. It's just, you're all good no matter what you do. But obviously, we do love them unconditionally. So it needs to be there. And they need to get a sense of feedback for the things that they're doing, that these things are the things that are good and mommy and daddy are proud of and are positive. So it's a balance between the things that are good and are good. Whatever the numbers are, whether or not it means 60, 20, 40, 40, that was the way that they presented it. And I present them as two things to keep in mind in your homes as we go through this, and we'll develop this. You don't like the numbers?
No, I don't have an issue with the numbers. As the term conditional love throws
me. Yeah, it's about whatever. It's a term of responding to something that they did.
Any notion that a child might have some idea that you don't unconditionally love them?
Yeah, thank you. A term of 50% of our statements being out of the blue, not in response to anything that they did, you're amazing. And then positive comments in response to things that they've done, noting it, commenting on it, not saying that this is a conditional. That's a bad word. I thank you for that. Okay, now, when you think about saying things of unconditional love, think about yourselves now and how often in your home you say things like that. And if you do, what are the kinds of things that you say?
Which way are you talking?
Unconditional love, just out of the blue.
When I took the kids and I say, mommy and daddy love you so much.
Yeah, so things like that? Anything more creative than that? No, I mean this seriously.
I tell them, you're the best boy in the whole world. And if you ever hear me tell anyone else, I mean besides you.
That I'm honored that they're a kid.
Okay, so this is an important thing. I myself, when I thought about this, realized that I really had nothing that I ever said other than, I love you. Like, that was it. That was like my repertoire of statements that I made to my children of, I love you. Which I imagine from their perspective probably ran pretty dry after a while. It had very little meaning to it. So I'm going to share with you a couple of things that I started doing in my home, and I opened it. You're welcome to borrow them. I don't feel in any way copyrighted in anything. But just the idea of what it means to create a home where they feel the way. So I ran a test to see if I'd been successful this week. As each individual kid took a bath, I started, and just to give you a sense of how kids go, I started with my 4-year-old, and I said to him, I said, Shlomo, what's the greatest gift Daddy ever got in the whole wide world? You know what he said? He said, me. You know why he says that? It's because I tell him that all the time. So when I said to my 4-year-old, just in the middle of the night, I said, what was the greatest present I ever got? He said, me. So I asked my 6-year-old, when it was his turn, I said, Ephraim, what's the greatest gift Daddy ever got in the whole wide world? He said, me. Right away. He said, okay, I'm doing well. It means I have said this often enough, over and over and over again. So I asked my 7-year-old boy, I said, Benjamin, what's the greatest gift Daddy ever got? Not me, which to me is success. Because I mean, okay, he's getting old enough where like this, that particular route, but he knows the answer in him saying, oh, it's not me. So that's fine. I said, okay, that's success. So I get to my 9-year-old daughter. So I say, what's the greatest gift Daddy ever got? So she says, Rena. So that's one of them. Shlomo. Mm-hmm. Ephraim. Binyamin. Uh-huh. Mommy. Mm-hmm. That's it. So you see the development as they get older. Like the 7-year-olds on it enough. I'm not going to answer me. And then the next stage at 9 already is, I know what you want, and I get it, but you're not going to get me to say me. Which is totally fine, because in the way that they're thinking, when I say the words greatest gifts, they're thinking it's our family. That's their standard answer. Now, the only way that that happens is because they hear that all the time. They hear those words. You are Hashem's greatest, and I always put Hashem into it so they get the connection that I feel that Hashem gave me the greatest gift. I have 5 greatest gifts, and when they hear that, they know that that's how it goes. Now, on what level does a 4-year-old get that? I don't know. But enough that as you see them getting older, but he has that in his mind. I remember when Baltimore once, one of the families that I went to had in their break fronts, where most people keep their silver, they had all their pictures of their children at their wedding days, like, you know, 7 or 8 different frames. Like, that was their treasure. So there are ways in which we convey to our children that feeling. And one of them is you say it over and over, and you find the way to do that. I would, as I mentioned, we have a lot of football players in my family. So when I have the opportunity to tackle them, which I will do often, I will not let them get up. So while I have them going, I'll ask, I have a question for you. Say, why does Daddy love you so much? And then they're stuck until they come up with good answers. Now, this is a great exercise, and the answers have been fed to them from previous experiences where I would just say anything. So the answers are usually because I'm so cute, because I'm delicious, and because Hashem gave me to you as a present. And I will have my children will actually say these things because they know that they're going to get tickled and stuck on the ground. It's a game, and it's in fun, but there's just a dialogue in which is being inculcated into them that they feel cute, they feel delicious, and they feel that they're a gift. That they know that they can respond, that they're I'll catch them. Again, I'm just sharing things that I've done. Either I've seen others do them. You do them. Find your own. This is the things in terms of, like, again, when I was sitting in these seats, I was like, I love you. That was the extent. These are just things that, like, over the years we've created. I will catch one of the younger ones. The bigger ones don't like this as much, but one of the younger ones in the kitchen, give him a kiss on the cheek, and say, like, oh my goodness. Oh my, mommy, come here. You're not going to believe this. This, whoever it is more delicious today than he was yesterday. You're not going to believe it. Try it yourself. And you just play this game. Again, this works for younger kids, which mostly still have younger kids, in which they're just hearing the words that randomly out of nowhere, they're going to get scooped up, and an entire episode will be played between me and my wife as to, I don't know, is he more delicious than yesterday? Isn't he? I think he is. Let me try the other cheek. Let me try his belly. Until we come to a conclusion that, in fact, yes, he is more delicious today than he was yesterday. And I'm like, how is that possible? What do you do? Just playing up these kinds of games. If you ever have a Friday night meal alone with a family, many people obviously have company, either you're going out, you're hosting, should never let a Friday night in which it's just your family go by without an announcement before Kiddush. Like, as I'll say, Mommy, this is the greatest family in the world. This is just amazing. Something along those lines. But it should never have an opportunity where it's just your family, because we live lives that are so often not just our family. If you ever have that opportunity, it's a Friday night, maybe they're at the table, if you get them all at the table for the same second, just for that one second, make sure there's an announcement where they are constantly hearing how amazing it is that they're part of this family, that you feel that they're part of this family, and that they just simply hear that over and over and over again, that they're a delicious family, they're delicious children. How do they get more delicious today than they were yesterday? All of these things. These are just things which are just regular. They're just commonly heard that make a tremendous difference. That it should be that if anyone would ask my 5-year-old in the street, what was your father's greatest gift? He'll just say me. That's an amazing thing that a kid should feel that way. And life is going to throw them enough challenges. They have to deal with enough stuff that they should come out of our home feeling that their parents feel the world about them, and that they express that. I heard once, really where I got this from, aside from the stuff, is there's a certain teacher who has made famous that on field trips, the whole way there in the bus, She says, we're going to have a great time. We're going to have the best time. It's going to be amazing. And the whole time while they're at the field trip, she's saying to the kids, this is so much fun. This is amazing. We're having a blast. And on the bus ride home, the whole time is, we had the best time. We had an amazing time. We had a blast. So the kids get home. The parents say, what'd you do today? We had a fun time. We had a blast. That's what they think they did. So if you tell them, all right, that's what we did. So the parents are happy and everybody like does really well. But the truth is, there's a lot of truth and chokhmah to that, in the sense of, as the kids grow, and they'll get older, but if it's already inculcated at a young age, at 4 and at 5, so then when they hit 7, and they're smart enough to say, well, not me, but they really know that it's them, and that the 9-year-old is smart enough to know, when you ask that question, what's my greatest gift, it's in the family. There's no question. She's going to go through every family member, she'll be too embarrassed to say herself, but who's the greatest gift? She's keeping it in the family, she knows. That's the response of her parents. That's what they hold to be the greatest gifts they ever received. And it's amazing that if we don't say these things to our kids, I mean, Sam, like, spending a lot of time in this, they won't know it. We think we'll be able to, like, it's so much easier if it's just part of the family routine. They hear it from us, they know it, and you might find it uncomfortable at first saying it. It's like almost odd, we don't talk this way usually. It's well worth it. And come up with your own little gift, every family. I'm just sharing some of the things that goes on in my family. But, it's well worth it. Find your own words, find your own routines, whatever games you want to play, but that they should know, just out of nowhere, regularly, they get bombarded with compliments, they get bombarded with, you are so cute, this is ridiculous how cute you are, just things like that, out of nowhere. How'd you do it? I literally, as the kids get older, like, sitting like, tell me what you did. I want to be cute like you, and I don't know what to do. And they, you know, it's a game, and they laugh, and they run away, but it's worthwhile just drilling it into their heads. Okay, that's it for the unconditional love, so that hopefully you will all walk out of here with some other things other than I love you so much, which is great, but there should be some other. Oh, my thank you Hashem song. I'll do that later. Okay. Okay, now the art of praise. That's so half our comments to our kids are just out of nowhere. The first thing they do when they wake up, how did you get to be so cute? What kind of night sleep did you have? Stuff like that. Now, the other types of comments are in response to things that they've done. We want to give them praise. Praise, if you've experienced, is a very tricky business. It is not so simple to give praise in a way that it's received. Now, all of you have experienced this in your marriages, I am sure, but because of the difficulty of this, and let me just give a couple of examples of where we run into trouble. I had a story that happened to me that's about a year and a half ago now. In my position as the assistant rabbi, so very often people come here collecting money, and they end up in my office. So one fellow came and he didn't have a place to stay. Different people come there on different levels of having it together in their organization. One guy, he had nothing, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And he found odds and ends. He was sleeping in the shul a little bit. But I told him, he asked me, I told him, for Shabbos, I'll find you a place. I mean, Tuesday or Wednesday, I said, I'll have you a place for Shabbos. I forgot. I slipped my mind. Didn't take care of it. It's Friday morning. I see him Friday morning. Where am I going for Shabbos? Oh, gosh, I forgot. I'll find your place. I'll get you. So I run around Friday. I call up somebody to help me find him. Like, she calls me back at, I don't know, maybe it was like noon. Great. I go to the base medrash to find him, and he's nowhere to be seen. I don't know where he is. Maybe he's shopping for some stuff, walking around. I don't know. 12, 1, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Shabbos is at like 6, 7 o'clock. I don't know where he is. I finally got a place for him, and I'm feeling absolutely dreadful that I committed to find the guy a place. Now it's 3 o'clock. He doesn't know where he's going for Shabbos. And I just, horrible. Finally, at 3 o'clock, I'm driving around running an errand, and the woman who helped me find him a place calls me. He had either just called her, he found her, she's at shul, or whatever. That's where he is. I said, oh, amazing. I'll go get him and bring him over to the house. Her response to me was this, I remember this, like, so she said, Rabbi Freilich, you'll get him yourself? I said, yeah, it's not a problem, I'll take care of it. Your chesed knows no bounds. We are so blessed to have you in this community. I don't even have words. On an Erev Shabbos, you're going to drive. I can't even believe it. Thank you so much. What's my reaction?
Yeah, whatever.
I am ready to vomit. Like, I can't, like, I am feeling horrible that I left this guy out here. Like, I'm already running an errand anyway. This is literally 10 extra seconds. I feel terrible. Now you come with this, like, you are chesed knows no bounds. Oh, please. Right? So how do you think how did I respond, like, thank you very much, like, not taken well? Why is that not taken well? Like, break it down. Like, why don't I accept that compliment?
I think most of people didn't grow up with it. I'm
you don't believe it.
No, I don't believe it.
Every time I interact with this person and she lavishes the praise, and it's so genuine, I really feel like it's because at some level, not that my parents weren't, they were, but I think the general society, we sort of grow up and doesn't. We grow up as kids sort of insulting each other in school, and the idea of praise and just accepting it is very, somehow makes me feel very vulnerable.
Okay, now we'll get to why that is. I think in this particular example, there's a much more fundamental reason.
You felt bad that you put it off and you...
Because I didn't deserve it. I feel it's not true. I, like, failed this particular task. I was saved last minute. The fact that I'm willing to drive him to wherever he needs to go is a result of the fact that, A, I'm out already, and, B, I feel responsible for the mess in the first place. So when you respond, even though you're saying a nice thing, and maybe it's true that my chesed no knows bounds, and the community is so lucky to have me, but I'm not feeling that right now, given the episode that it's coming after. So when the compliment comes in a way that I don't feel it accurately portrays what I've done to deserve it, we then for sure will have that reaction of, not interested, leave it, no thanks. Just a couple, another example. Say for example, I've never seen this happen, but someone told me about this. Woman's trying to get dressed shop this morning, and it's just one of those mornings that's just, it's not going well. Nothing fits, it's the wrong color, it's the wrong season. By the time you're done, your entire wardrobe is on your bed. Every last article of clothing that you have is sitting there. You finally get yourself together, head to toe is ready to go, get the kids, run to shul. By the time you get there, everybody's ready, beginning to leave. You're all exasperated, and the first person you see says, "Oh my goodness, you look gorgeous today. How do you always pull this off that you look so good?" How do you feel at that moment receiving that compliment?
Still vain. I kind of like it.
So some, would some people have the action of, "Well, you should have seen me an hour ago. You know, running around my house like a chicken without a head, trying to figure out what I was going to wear. You should see the mess that I left." It may leave that feeling of, well, let's say they say, "You look amazing. You always look so put together."
Oh, yeah.
Let's say they say it like that.
So I'll tell them, "You should have seen me, but I love it." I'll be like, "You should have seen me."
So if I say it in a way that you always look put together, so then that often creates an anxiety of, that's why I got to do this every week, taking my entire wardrobe, because I feel the pressure of being able to keep that up. You sometimes have that kind. You sometimes have, threatening, whether or not it's an immediate denial. Sometimes you have a comment of, you have unexpected guests for dinner. Husband brings someone home. You throw together some leftovers over a bag of rice. You serve it totally, last minute. And the person says, "You are a fantastic cook. This is delicious." So you usually say, either you don't know what you're talking about, or you're just saying that to be nice, because, this is just leftover chicken that was reconstituted into a little sauce so that I could hide the fact that it was, frozen from a week before that and served on this Shabbos over a bed of rice. Like, what do you mean I'm a great cook? So very often what happens is when we praise, we are not giving accurate descriptions of what the person who has put something together did or has accomplished, so that they, when they receive it, often don't feel it as being an accurate assessment of what they did, or they focus on the weakness. One of my kids is playing soccer. If I said to him, "You were great on offense," and his first response was, "They scored on me." Like over the course of a 15-minute stint in which he kicked away, 15 balls, one scored, and his first response to my telling him, "You were awesome today," was, "Yeah, they scored on me." Right, he focuses on the weeks. And we as adults often have that when we receive a compliment. We very often in our minds, as adults, sometimes we're even not so good at that, even we actually respond that way, but certainly in our minds we'll say, "Yeah, but," and we'll focus on some weakness or feel anxiety or threatened. It's not so easy to often praise in a way that it's accepted. So what Chaim Gino or Ginat, whatever his name is, what he develops as a main thing which they pick up on as well is the idea of evaluating versus describing. hopefully terms that you've seen when it comes to praise, but if you haven't heard it or you have it, to go over it, it's amazing how easy it is to slip up on this. The difference between evaluating when we praise and describing what it is that we saw as we do it. Okay, I'll give in. I'll pass these around. So I do, these are, everything in here are drawings straight out of this book, so all the copyrights right in here, and just to work it through. So we'll go through these different tools that's on the cover. Yeah, some good cartoons. So we're going to, the concept of evaluating versus describing. Very often the praise, if you just pay attention, if you listen, I have more here that everybody can get. Yeah. Everybody, yeah? I have more if you want.
Each person get one?
You can, yeah. For the same price. Your $18 covers two copies. Very often when we praise, what we're doing is we're evaluating the person that we're praising. We're evaluating in the sense of, I feel you did a good job. I give you my approval. I think that you as a person are this, are a good cook, are a good artist. And when we evaluate with our praise, the person who receives it very often is uncomfortable with that. Because when you evaluate me, I will either always respond with the weaknesses why I feel your evaluation is off, or it makes me nervous to be evaluated that way. When you tell me how good I am, the first thing that I think about are all the things that say, that's not true. What do you mean I'm so good? I know that I've done many things that aren't good. You're the biggest helper I ever had, we'll say to our children. And they don't respond to that because they remember very well that they haven't always been the biggest helper. They don't always do things which are so helpful to us. But we just define them as a big helper. And they respond in the same way that we as adults do when we hear things which evaluate us. So instead of defining their character and their personality, the words that we use have to describe what it is that they did, their effort and their accomplishment. For example, just tonight, my daughter just started a piano lesson, so she's three lessons in, and anyone who's taken piano knows it takes a long time to learn how to play piano, and she's already now up to using her right hand and her left hand at the same time, and getting it together is not easy. So as she practices, Sivi Von Sof, which we all know very well, it's all through her, but if you listen to it, it sounds a lot more like noise than music, because it's one note at a time. And then there's the next note, and there's a mistake in that until she corrects it, and then it's the next note, and it's a, she's working hard at it, and it's getting better and better and better, but it's not yet a seamless piece that's being played. It's a person who just started piano, and she's doing great. Now, how do you respond when you want to give her a compliment? If you walk by and say, that sounds great, so I just evaluated how it sounds. Now, she knows that it doesn't sound great. Now, it sounds a whole lot better than it did 2 days ago, without question. But if I say, wow, that sounds great, I'm most likely going to get a response of, no, it doesn't. Or, I made this mistake, or I made that mistake, because I just said it sounds great, I evaluated how I feel it, but and it doesn't really ring true. And very often we do things like that, and therefore a better response would have been something like,
better than yesterday.
You're working hard.
You're working so hard on this. It's amazing to see how hard you're working on that piece. I could see how much better it's gotten. That's a compliment that rings true. I am working very hard. I then let them come to the conclusion, I'm getting good at this. So, for example, just to read these are excellent little cartoons. The part of the book, I highly recommend it. Again, there are cartoons throughout. But just on this first page, all right, instead of evaluating the first one, like, you cleaned your room, what a good girl you are. Like, how many times have we heard that? Good girl, good boy, mitzvah girl, all these things. They really respond as they have, right? I'm not so good, I stuffed some toys under the bed. We naturally respond to that when you just define who I am in a way that I don't find to be true. So instead you describe it. I see a lot of work has been going on, all the blocks are back on the shelf, every record's in its jacket, every marble. Now maybe there are some toys stuffed under the bed, that's fine. I didn't say, I described what I saw her do. Now this is, let's go to the bottom one. Kid writes a poem. So the mother says in the inappropriate way of doing it, this is lovely, you write good poetry. Right, evaluate, it's not like we would not, that's how we normally would speak. But it responds like, I don't know, does she mean it? Is it true? I didn't know it was so good. I was like, I'm not sure. So instead, she could describe, I'm very moved by your poem about the ego. I especially love the line of the heart of giant wings. Describe some part, describe how you respond to it, what it means to you. Our kids do this all the time. They show us a Lego that they built. and they'll say, either they'll say straight out, what do you think? Do you like it? How is this? And we will often respond, oh, it's amazing, things like that. Instead, learn to get in the habit of describing what it is that you see. Wow, I see a base of red and orange and yellow and then two big towers. It looks like a car. And they'll say, no, it's a house. Yes, I see a house and a window. And that's totally fine to get it wrong in your describing it. Let them tell you what it is. Sometimes I'm so clueless what it is, I'll say, whoa, what is that? Instead of saying, yes, I love it. Or it's amazing. I'm not gonna tell me what that is. I see a lot of things, but I'm not sure when. They'll make up a whole story. I was at your house, so the Kurzners have on their wall. I hope not embarrassing, but it's up there on the wall, so everyone can see a beautiful painting by their 3-year-old. It's one color, it's blue, and it's just blue everywhere. Just blue, all over the night. So I know what it was, but it happens to have been labeled by the teacher. The teacher labeled it squirrel eating acorn, something like that. So I was at the house. I was learning with my chavruta with Ellie. So in the middle, he got up to get something. So little Bissell was sitting there. So I say, wow, I see a picture of a squirrel eating an acorn. And he says, yeah. And there are people. They're eating peaches. Oh, and over there, there's someone playing with the game. And it's just this, you know, just picture of all blue. This is what you'll get standard. When you don't say just like, oh, it's amazing. Let them tell the story. The teachers are great when they label that guy. Like, let's say that would come home, and without the label of squirrel eating acorn. It's just like, or every 3-year-old in the world comes home with this painting of lines and squirrels. Like, so, and they say, here, Mom. So what's your response? So instead of evaluating what it is, it's, oh, I see circles and lines and dots. And let them, they'll go back, they'll respond to it. I had an instance in my house we had guests over Shabbos, I don't remember who it was, for a Simcha family, the little kid, and Sunday morning they were sitting at the table eating breakfast, and I was schmoozing with the husband, and their little 2-year-old came with a piece of paper he'd been drawing in the other room, squigglies, like nothing there. So he just put it on the table. I don't know if the father said anything. If I was making up the story, I would say, and the father said, that's amazing. And I don't know if he did that or not, whatever. And so I looked at it, so I said, wow, I see red and yellow and blue. So the kid took it, ran back to his room, and came back and gave it to me again. I said, ooh, I see you added a yellow line. Took it again, ran back, and came back again. And I said, I see a blue circle. And literally for 5 minutes, 10 times, the kid was so engaged, and it was just a matter of, as opposed to him handing it and you say, that's amazing, and at the end of the story, just learning to describe what it is that you see going on, the kids are entirely engaged, and they will play that with Legos, with their games, with their in their sports, in their piano, at every stage of the game. That is the way to be able to express in a productive way what's going on. Try it in your marriages, you'll see it's amazing. To me, not you're amazing, you're the best. Describe what it is that your spouse did. That you were able to get dinner on the table with all that's going on. That's fantastic. Thank you. That's a totally different compliment than you're just amazing. That's meaningless. Taking the time to actually be able and describe something that the child did is a totally different game. So I had in the past life been very frustrated with mitzvah notes. I used to hate mitzvah notes. Really, I couldn't tolerate them. It was like the bane of our existence, that the morning of school, like added to everything else, now we needed to like come up with them. Oh, gosh, mitzvah notes. I had a totally different perspective, because what they forced you to do is catch your child doing something specific. None of this, my child's a mitzvah, that doesn't work on a mitzvah note. You actually need to describe something that they did. And as parents, we need to get in the habit of having at the tips of our tongues, catching our children, doing specific things, and getting in the habit of being able to do that, of pointing to something specific. This is what you did. You were sensitive and thoughtful by doing this. So, and that was sensitive. So I'm not going to define you as a sensitive and thoughtful person, because maybe sometimes you're not. But this instance, this episode, showed that because you did this, and that resonates within the children, it's a great habit. So this is at the Thank You Hashem. So it's one of our bedtime routine, one of the things that we do, And Rivka came up with this. I take no credit for it. Is the Thank You Hashem song? It's Tov Lahodos for the Tov Lahodos Hashem song. And then for the high part, instead of doing the regular part, it's Thank You Hashem for. And then we, whichever kid's being put to bed, it's Thank You Hashem for Binyamin Yitzchak. And then it's the He's such a delicious boy. We are so proud of him and we love him. And then the last line is left blank. And then that's where we have to fill in some reason why. We're so proud of him, we love him, he's so delicious, because he, and then fill something in that he did, because he was so helpful cleaning up from dinner, thank you Hashem for everything, and that's the song, and they, you see them like, you know, waiting for their line, because it's at the end, and it's thank you Hashem for friends, oh man, you're such, and it's just like, you know, what's mommy and daddy, what are they going to get today, what are they, and to be ready to always come up with something specific to insert. It's a great song because it starts with thank you Hashem for so-and-so. It just, again, it's that constant that they feel that I am bringing Hashem and thanking him for this gift, and then something specific describing what it is that he did. And it's a great little bedtime routine in switching back to love and logic. They know they don't have time for their thank you Hashem song. Like they miss that. That's something worth getting in bed for because it's their one time. It's like hard with kids all over the place, but this is their moment. They're being put to bed. It's just whichever parent's putting that child to bed, singing about them, and coming up with something specific that they did. Wouldn't you all love if, as you fell asleep at night, your spouse would say something specific that was great that you did while they're so proud of you? Specific, not just saying you're amazing, you're awesome. They would be able to say and point to something every night, something different, and say that. The kids love it. It's an amazing feeling being in bed, being put to bed by a parent who's making the song specific to them. So it's not just something. There are a bunch of other songs that they get, but it's just something that's theirs. They get their own words and their own little connection to it. And when the praise comes in something which you're describing, as opposed to anything else, is very, very powerful. Okay, flip the page to number two. So they have some suggestions of summing up with a word. Learning to put a word to a child's behavior. Now, some of the examples here are a little bit older, but you could adapt them to your children. For example, on the left-hand side of the page, you've been working to memorize that vocabulary for over an hour. Now, that's what I call perseverance. Give your children the words to describe what it is that you see them doing. Right? You said you'd be home at 5 o'clock, and it's exactly 5 o'clock. How do you respond when your child comes home on time? Like, great, you know, you've been working on this, you sent him out, and now he's actually home on time. So describe that with a word. Wow, that's what I call being punctual. That's great. That's right on time, exactly. That's taking the initiative, finding the different examples. And then the right-hand side, they have just, you know, leaving it up for us for homework to fill in the words. But that's just always describing what it is that you see. Right? A child takes the initiative and helps, clean up from dinner. So how do you respond when you want to acknowledge what your child did? So learn to describe what it was that you saw. Wow, you saw that mommy was on the phone and you put away the dishes on your own. That's what I call, that's being responsible, taking the initiative. That's being so helpful. So that I'm just describing, always describing, as opposed to evaluating. If you listen to yourselves in our regular talk without paying attention, you will see how much we evaluate with our praise in terms of how we feel about it as opposed to just describing and let the child come to their conclusions on their own. Okay, make sense? Okay, you will see. I highly recommend that was a brief. They both talk at great length about this idea, so it's worth reading and rehashing, and you'll catch each other in your homes how often it's so easy to do that, where we evaluate how the child did as opposed to describing what they did. Okay, tool number two. So Chaim Gino has a great topic to one of his chapters in which he writes, fish swim, birds fly, and people feel. It's just the reality. Just like that's what fish do, they swim and birds fly. People have feelings. And children have feelings, just like we have feelings. Now, we don't always appreciate the feelings that the kids have, just like we sometimes don't appreciate the feelings that we have, but they are there. And what happens is, Dr. Guinot holds that children, when they're misbehaving, it's because they're struggling with they're a feeling that they have that's either not being recognized or being dealt with, or they're not sure how to handle or what it is. And if we could get them aligned with their feelings, if we can teach them how to cope, label, and address certain things, they'll be much better at it. Now, we have a hard time with this, because what do we often do? Just as an example, you make a big birthday party for your three-year-old, put all the stops, everything is there, and everyone leaves, and they say, I had such a dumb birthday party. What's our gut response? No, you didn't. We had so much fun. We had all your friends over, and we had a great time, and we had cake and presents. And they're expressing that they had a dumb birthday party. Now, we'll have to see what that means. But we deny the feeling, and instead of accepting that they feel they had a dumb birthday party, we actually tell them what they did have. No, you didn't have a dumb birthday party. You actually had a good time. And we do that with simple things. Sometimes our children will say, I'm so cold. We'll say, no, you're not. It's warm in here. What gives us the right, like, your child just said that they're cold, and we say, no, it's not. It's warm. You don't need a sweater. It's warm in here. What do you mean? Your child just said they're cold. Let the child be cold. We often get into the habit of not allowing them to feel confident with their feelings because we deny it. Especially if they say, I hate my sister. No, don't say that. You don't hate your sister. You love your sister. No, I hate my sister. Or even say, I hate Bubby. Ooh, right? Bubby's coming. I hate Bubby. Right, how do you respond to parents when you hear that?
My mother.
That was going to be my next line, right? That's really bad. I mean, how do we respond when our child says, I hate Grandma. I hate Bubby. So most of the time, most of us left to our own devices would say, oh, no you don't. Don't say something like that. Remember last time she came and she took you out and you had a great time? And we would sort of convince the child of something other than what they themselves were expressing. As their children will get older, they'll come home with things like, I'm terrible at math. I'm a horrible artist. Or you name it, they'll come up with it that they're horrible at. And our gut reaction is to deny what it is that they're claiming and replace it with what it is that we want them to either feel, think, or express. So, both of these, the approach of Chaim Guinot and of Faber Mazel is to learn to accept children's feelings, and most importantly, especially with young children, teach them what it is that they're feeling. Most of the time, the children, they don't have a vocabulary to understand when they're conflicted between different things. When a child, just as an example, says, Bubby's coming today, and they say, I hate Bubby. I'm just making up a scenario. Very often what happens is, they actually were planning on having a play date, or they were thinking that they were going to be able to play outside soccer, and now when Bubby comes, they're not going to be able to do that. And they don't know how to deal with the conflict of, well, I really wanted to do this, but I love seeing my Bubby, but then when Bubby comes, I can't do this. So it comes out in a three-year-old in the form of, I hate Bubby. I don't want her to come because I want to be doing something else. But I don't really hate Bubby. I don't know how to handle the fact that children are complex beings just like we are, but they don't have the vocabulary to deal with it. So part of our role as parents is to educate the children on the feelings that they have and accepting them and dealing with them. So there are a couple of great cartoons which are the best way to really introduce this, which let's do that. First one on the first page is obvious to all, but I included it. I didn't photocopy everything, obviously, but because I've just noticed myself how, you know, this is like obvious stuff, but I'm really bad at it, and I'm sure the rest of us are also. Half listening and listening with full attention. We as parents are so convinced that we are Superman and woman, that we can do many things at once, and while we're cooking, learning, studying, reading, watching a game, whatever, we can also listen to our kids. And just like your spouse knows when you're doing that, you can never fool a spouse. If you're reading an email while you're on the phone with them, they know before you finish the third word of the email that you've checked out. So guess what? Our kids know it too. You're not listening. You're busy doing something else. So the first thing to be able to hear them is to be aware of this. Again, this is so obvious, but it needs to be said and re-said and read it and reread it. So that's just number one. Now, number two is, I remember I was in someone's house when I was in high school, and I just saw this book lying around. It was a different version. And I saw this cartoon, and it left such an impression on me, just this cartoon of the turtle dying. If you haven't seen it before, it's worth reading it together, because this happens all the time. A little girl comes home from school, and her turtle is dead. So what does Dad say? Don't get so upset. Don't cry. It's just a little turtle. So she continues wailing, and he says, and he gets all frustrated. Stop that. It's just a turtle. Buy you another one. You're getting a reasonable, and the whole system, the whole situation basically entirely collapses. The appropriate response is give the feeling a name. She comes home and she says, my turtle is dead. He was alive this morning. I don't need to explain. I don't need to say it's not so bad. It's not so sad. Acknowledge that. That's such a shock. He was my friend. Losing a friend can hurt. It's fun to do tricks. You two had fun together. I fed it. The kids respond to that. You can't, again, this goes back to things you can control and can't control. Can we control whether or not the turtle's going to be alive anymore? Turtle's dead. So we can convince the child that she's not sad. We can convince her that she doesn't really miss her. We can convince the child that we could buy another one, but that's not dealing with what's in front of us, which is the child who's sad that her turtle died. So the response, oh, that's so sad. You missed the turtle. You had so much fun. And then if the child suggests getting another one, great. If not, no, you're just there with the child. This past Shabbos, so one of my older children had a friend to play. So as older children get older and they have their own friends to play, they very often will go to their room and play by themselves, not including their two younger brothers, because older brothers don't necessarily like playing with younger brothers. So I had the following scene play itself out literally a minute apart. Sitting at my Shabbos table, I have my guests. The older of the two younger brothers comes in crying. So lock the door and he's playing without me. Crying. Gut reaction. Now, again, none of you would do this, but some homes, what would happen is, I'll take care of that. And you storm to the room and you pound down the door and you say, you will play with your younger brother if you ever want to have a friend again. No one would ever do anything because that's obviously ridiculous. But I've actually seen that being done. Every once in a while you see that. That doesn't help. Now, break down the situation now where you don't have to deal with your guest and your kid who's crying in front of you. Can you make an older brother play with his younger brother? Older brothers don't want to play with their younger brothers. Older brothers will significantly resent younger brothers being forced into they have a friend over. So now we have a problem. We have a younger brother who wants to play with an older brother, who is now crying at your Shabbos table because he's been locked out of his older brother's room, and really there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, you could force the older brother. That's not going to work. What's the response? No, so what would you do?
I'm sorry. That must really stink.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel good.
You really want to play in there.
Now,
I'm sorry.
You really, you know, and then I gave him a couple choices. Would you like to sit here on my lap, or would you like to play in the playroom with a different toy? But one of the options, as much as he was trying to goad me into going to his older brother and demanding that he play with him, because that's what every child worth keeping is trying to get us to do as parents. They want us to do that because that's what he wants. He wants to be able to play. But it's not an option because I can't force an older brother, nor am I interested in forcing an older brother. So I now have a younger child sitting and crying. So I'm not going to get engaged with that. That's so sad. I'm so sorry. Would you like to stay here on my lap? Or would you like to play a different game in the playroom? So he wanted to stay on my lap. Now, he knows the rules, no crying at the table. So if he was going to cry, we'd have to go elsewhere. But he was fine. Stopped crying. Sat at the table. Sat on my lap a little bit. While he's sitting on my lap for about 30 seconds, the next younger brother comes, crying that he was locked out of his older brother's room, but he's a little bit less sophisticated because he's still younger. And his claim was, it's not fair. He always gets friends coming over, and I never have a friend who gets to play. It's a great little difference between the 6-year-old and the 4. The 6-year-old wants to play with them. The 4-year-old is just upset that he doesn't, that's not fair. Like, of course I'm not going to lie. So now, same situation, I got a 4-year-old now, I got ready, I got one kid on my lap because he's been locked out, and I have a second one crying because he never has anybody coming over to play. Gut reaction would normally have been, oh, that's not true, just last week we had Chaim Leibowitz over and you were playing with him. Helpful or unhelpful? Unhelpful. Now, it happens to be true that he says he never has anyone over to play. What's the feeling that he's really going through right now? I want to play with somebody, I don't have anybody to play with. So instead of denying his feeling or getting involved in an argument with a 4-year-old over whether or not it is or is not true, whether or not he does have play dates or he doesn't have play dates, which I've seen that happen very often as well, that's not going anywhere. That's an unproductive argument, especially at your Shabbos table with a crying 4-year-old. It's a matter of, oh, you really want to have a play date with somebody to play with? Yeah. Well, we could. Should we go over after lunch, or should we invite somebody for next week, or why don't you remind me, it's always good to put it back on, why don't you remind me next Friday, and we'll call somebody. You know, 4-year-olds maybe will or will not remember, but it's just addressing and responding to the child that's so sad that you don't have anybody to play with. Now I have two kind children, and I can make the suggestion of, hey, why don't you guys play together? Which they rejected, but that's fine. Right? And within 10 minutes later, they eventually ended up playing together. But it's a matter of just not engaging. Like, they are both dealing with different feelings, and it's a matter of being with them as they're dealing with it, as opposed to denying or telling them what they should or should not feel. They want to have a play date. That's so, and then you're getting used to saying the words, I know, that's so sad, I really wish you could have a play date also, it just didn't work out. And just allowing them to express and or explain to them what that feeling is, that disappointment, that they were going through and it didn't work out, whatever it may be. In the next cartoon, so it gives another tool, which is when children really want something, instead of explanations and logic, which do not work in the heat of a moment with a 4-year-old. It just doesn't. So you could sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's just another tool to go over. Give the child his wish and fantasy. I have tried this with much success. Sometimes, you know, as the kids get older, it does not work, but as they're younger, which is what the drawing here is picturing, it often does. You can argue with your 4-year-old that you don't have the cereal. It's not in the house. So you get involved in a fight. I want it. I don't have it. I don't have it. How about this? You're acting like a baby. That's all the left-hand side. Right? And the other option is, you know, you just, I wish I can give you this, and I wish we could do that, and I wish we can, and whatever the wish may be, it's almost like taking their sides of, I know, I really wish I had it, but I want it, I know, I wish I could give it to you. And instead of getting involved in a fight, but you know you don't have the, I don't have it in the house. We can't have it, I don't have it, so instead of getting in a fight, giving that wish in fantasy is a great little tool. As well, and lastly, on the next page is instead of questions and advice. This is a great little cartoon. You could read it along as I'm speaking. A little girl comes home and somebody stole my new pencil. Now this was the hardest one not to get involved in. We right away start interrogating. All right. Well, are you sure you didn't lose it? Where'd you last put it? So as soon as that happens, when we get interrogated as adults, what's the first thing that happens to us? Right? Totally defensive, mind shuts off, creativity is out the window. So when we do that to our children, and we are so good at that, because children always come home having lost things, misplaced things, forgotten things. That's why they're children. That's what they do for a living. They're good at it. And we right away come with any type of attack, affront to why not, where was this? There, you're going to get involved in some type of escalating dialogue that's going to end up being very unproductive because of the fact that they don't have an answer to most of these questions. So instead, learn to acknowledge with the word. Now again, things don't always work out exactly as they do in the cartoons, but they come pretty close. Right? Somebody stole my red pencil. Really? That's a great response. Oh my goodness. Oh, I didn't know that. Really? Had that? Just instead of a question, just acknowledging, let the child take it where they want to take it without imposing our interrogations into them. They will often come to great conclusions on their own. They'll be creative. This comes back to the love and logic thing of allowing children to make mistakes. If your child comes home having lost a red pencil and you blast them with a bunch of questions and comments, and they get all defensive, and they end up crying because the conversation doesn't go well, they're not going to be interested in coming home tomorrow and telling you that they lost their red pencil. Instead of what's going to happen when they lose their red pencil, they're going to feel guilty, they're going to hide it from you, they're not going to address it because it didn't go well. So let them experience at this young age the things that happen, just acknowledge with the word, allow it to happen, and you will see it helpful. Okay, those are some tools. Again, I'm going through this relatively quickly, in my mind at least, because you have them, you could read them, get the books, you'll go over them a lot, just as different things come up. Let me share with you two other quick things before I go on in the cartoons. Saying no. If you ever counted the amount of times you say no in your house, you will find it will far exceed 50, sometimes upwards of 100, because children are great at asking lots of questions, because they want lots of things, and the answer most of the time is actually no. I picked up my kids once from preschool and was going to run to Kroger or Publix, whatever it was, before Shabbos. And between the pickup and when we got to Kroger, I was bombarded with, can we stop off at Brewster's? Can we go to the bakery? Can we get this kind of cart? No, I want the car cart. Can we get a donut? Can we get a bagel? Can we have one of those drinks? Can we go home? Right. No. Because you're at like an event, you just want to strangle the poor kid. But that's what they do. It's just a constant stream of questions. Most of the time, the answer actually is no. So a great tool is to get into the habit of, instead of saying no, when the answer is no, is learn how to respond by telling the child when, where, or how they can have what it is that they want. So that instead of saying, can we go to the bakery, and the answer is going to be no, let's say, in that example, I always know if you're taking your kids to Kroger on Erev Shabbos, you're going to end up getting them something. Just have that in mind. That's the plan. Maybe it'll be a bagel, or a donut, or ice cream on the way home, something, but not everything. And if you already have in mind, if you can do this, just as an example, then your response is, sure, if you want to go to Kroger, or ice cream, the first question they ask, we can do that on the way home. If everything goes well, we go get out quick enough, we'll be able to stop off and get ice cream. Then you pass the bakery, and they say, oh, can we go to the bakery? So the answer is, instead of saying, no, we're going for ice cream, and yeah, if you'd rather do that, yeah, we can do that. And then when they ask about the bagel and the donut, it's always a matter of, if that's what you'd rather do, then fine. If you're at home, again, that's just playing off examples, and they want ice cream. After dinner, you can have, instead of saying no, let's say it's 5 o'clock and they ask for ice cream. So instead of saying no, say after dinner you can have. Or tomorrow, tomorrow, saying in the positive, tomorrow when it's earlier, you can have. I want this present. You're in Target. Every time you're in Target, your kids will ask you for everything in the store as they walk up and down. So no. So they know, you can say, sure. Would you like that for Hanukkah, for Pesach, or for your next birthday? That's when you can have it. Just start getting into the habit of responding with when or if after your room is cleaned. There's almost always a way in which the things that they ask for, there's a way of rephrasing your answer of no into, yes, the answer still is no, but there's a way or a time or a place where you can have it. It's just not now. So instead of them hearing this constant barrage of no to all of their questions, there's a better way to do it. You'll come up with all sorts of examples. If it's in your mind to pay attention to try to take the word no out of your vocabulary, you'll find it's a much more pleasant experience in general. I'm running with an eye on the clock. Another great tool, number four, is stories. This is a great, I discovered this one recently. Stories are the most amazing way of transmitting values to your children. The kid, everybody loves a story. The Chazal were aware of this thousands of years ago. All the way that they gave a lot of the lessons of the Torah over was through Agadah and through stories. When you hear a story, you can listen. It's not offensive when you hear a story. So I really learned this lesson because I have to do Shabbos party for anyone who has kids in the preschool. So I started giving them Dvar Torahs. And it didn't work at all, because I tried making it appropriate for a three-year-old, but I would see their eyes roll to the back of their heads as soon as I would start to talk, and I would ask my kids when they came home, what did you hear at Shabbos party? Like, nothing. So eventually I started telling stories, and I created these characters, Dove the Bear and Ari the Lion, and I tell stories about them. And it's always about midos, about a dispute or whatever it was, and it always comes out of things that I saw in my own house about my own children, so it's very easy to come up with these stories. And it imparts a lesson. And I've learned that it is a great way to teach something. So that, for example, if I have, this past week this happened, I had I drive a carpool with my neighbor to school, so my child always likes to be in the middle of the car, in the minivan, next to the baby. And when the neighbor tried to take that seat earlier this week, like started yelling and screaming, it's my seat, it's my seat, it's my seat. Now, how do you have a teaching moment? I have a four-year-old pitching a fit about what seat he's sitting in the car seat. You know, he could have used a love and lie, whatever. None of those things. It was like too late because the other kid gave in and moved to the back. So I didn't have to deal with two kids in the car fighting, which is a whole separate issue. I didn't have to deal with that. I just have to deal with the fact that I didn't really like the behavior that I saw my four-year-old exhibit bullying the neighbor into the back seat because he wasn't willing to give up his seat, even though you should be sharing. So how do you tell that to a four-year-old? So you can lecture him. You could sit him down. You could explain how to be nice and how to share. I haven't found that very successful with four-year-olds. But instead, I told a story about Dov the Bear and Ari the Lion, who had a very similar dilemma, believe it or not, of one of them always sat in this and the other one came. And now when we're talking about Dov the Bear and Ari the Lion, and I asked my four-year-old, what do you think he should have done? And he on his own says, well, first he should ask, you know, his friend who was in his seat if he would mind moving to the back. And he said it in the way that we've taught him that. Is it possible for you to move to the back? So I said, in my story, said, the kid said, no. I said, can you believe it? He's in your seat. And he said, no, he won't move. Now what should you do? So he thought about it and he came up with the idea, then he should move to the back and the next time he'll sit there. Well, wouldn't you know it, the following morning, in my car, that scene played itself out. And my child, who had never before done so, said, I'm going to be like Dove the Bear and move to the back. It was a lesson you can impart in a story that I could have never said in a way that he would hear. Because he's four. And just like, we don't like to hear Musar when it's said straight. You did this wrong, that's wrong, you should act like this. But if you say it to the child in a story where he's not talking about himself, he's talking about some made-up character, he's able to think it through, and now it's in his mind, and he's able to act on it. It's a great, so you could take Dove the Bear, Idle, make up your own characters. Bedtime, you want to tell stories to your kids. Your kids will love stories. I always view myself as never thought of myself as a storyteller. But I'm like making up these little things with little characters about stories. I'll tell Dove the Bear and Idle stories. They both wanted the same towel when they got out of their bath. Where do you think I got that one from? Well, because I got to deal with that every night. Now, they can't handle it when they're in the bath and they both want the same towel. No one's in a place to listen. A 4 and a 6-year-old are not able to hear. You're trying to teach them about sharing and taking turns. Not interested. I want the blue towel, Dad. And it doesn't go anywhere. But if when you have them in bed 20 minutes later, you tell them a story, and it's about some other characters, and it's something really eerily similar to what you just witnessed, they will be a totally different place. And whether or not you ask them to finish the story, or you just tell it to them, the lesson is imparted. And it's a tremendous tool. Don't ever underestimate the power of a story to get a lesson in. Make up stories, find stories about yourself. If you tell kids stories, my kids love, the older kids even, things that happened to me. I was in the supermarket and somebody cut me off in line, or somebody took the last thing. You tell them a story about what happened to you in your day, and how do you think I should have reacted, and what did I do? You will have your kids' attention telling them stories, especially if you do it at bedtime, where it means they go to sleep 5 minutes later. There is no greater time to impart your values to your children than at bedtime, because they are always ready to listen. And a story is such a great medium. It's non-offensive to the child, and you can manipulate it in any way that you can, that you want, to get the lesson, the circumstance. So you just watch your kids, and then make up a story. And you're welcome to take, like, you know, Dove the Bear, Ari the Lion, their characters, make up different names, different characters, and you just tell stories about what they were doing. And my kids, you know, it's like a standard thing, and it's a tremendous, tremendous tool to be able to get those lessons in a teaching moment. Because also, just to be aware, there are very often non-teachable moments in our parenting day. Like, we're not in a place, the kids are not in a place, and if they're, what are you going to do? I can't teach a child who's throwing a fit. But I can teach him an hour later when he's in bed in some other form. So that is a great little tool to be able to sneak in certain things. Okay, do the last three, it's worth it, finish it up. Yeah. Okay, engaging cooperation. This is one of the great ones. I'm doing this quickly. I suggest read the books, but go over the poems. This is one of the all-time greats. Describe, say it in a word. Here you have a father, right? How many times do I need to tell you to turn the bat light? All you need to say is, I see the light still on. Am I on the right page?
Yeah.
Yeah? Right? Mother needs the phone. Instead of, get off the phone, I need the phone. Don't tell the child what to do. Just describe the problem. I see a book bag on the floor is heard from a child totally different than pick up your book bag. Children don't like being told what to do any more than we do. But if you simply describe the problem and you don't give them a command and there's no time limit, it's just a matter of there's still clothing on the bathroom floor, is a much less offensive way of describing problems. Right? Who drank the milk and left the bottle standing out? Yeah, that's good, right? Everyone, not me. Right, somebody did it, but I don't pose that question to your children. So it's simply a matter of milk needs to be put back. That's not offensive. I'm teaching my children what needs to be done. Giving them information, describing it in a word, you find it far more effective. Now, it's, again, one of those things where, like, there have been a lot of things we've thrown out to get used to, into the habit of doing that, of simply describing what the problem is. Now, the reason why I love, when I present these things, the combination of this and love and logic, is because what happens when you describe it and nothing happens? But as far, I didn't tell my child what to do, so you put the two together, so there's clothing on the bathroom floor, the kids know it's their responsibility to put it in the hamper. So, they need to be reminded. So instead of saying, pick up the clothing, it's simply a matter of, you poke your head in, or you just over your shoulder while you're busy doing something else, describe, I still see clothing on the bathroom floor. If it's not picked up, then you shift into your love and logic mode, and there's some type of consequence for the fact that you had to do it instead of them doing it, but there, you just cut out the fight over picking up the clothing, because I'm going to say it in a non-offensive way, which a child can hear, by just describing and then seeing what happens. Yeah.
Isn't it just a different entrance?
In a good way or a bad way?
I guess in a good way. But you're still going to... Kids aren't going to be, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, that's fine. That's why I say, in other words, that's why you have the love and logic. In other words, if there's some form of... In other words, this is where you need them to be creative. What happens when clothing is left out? Is it just a matter of... You know, whatever it may be as far as the bedtime routine getting pushed out. But in other words, but you have to give the child the ability to do it. In other words, when you introduce, I'm telling you what to do, now, aside from letting the child make the decision of, I'm going to be responsible, I have to deal with the fact that I don't want to listen to what dad says. And even as adults, it's easier for us to hear instructions when I'm told, you know, honey, the garbage is full. It is a lot less offensive when you're in the middle of doing something, then saying, "Take out the garbage," I'll get to it. I didn't know it was empty. So now it's like I experience this as a husband, as an adult. I often respond when I'm told what to do, but I didn't know there was a problem. Why am I being like instructed in doing something in a way as if I didn't know the garbage was full. So children have that same, they're just on a much less sophisticated level. Like, they know their clothing. They really don't. In other words, when children take a bath and leave the clothing on the floor, they're not thinking of that 2 minutes later. So it's as if they don't remember. It's as if they didn't know the garbage was full. That's why we don't leave, that's why you should not leave your younger sibling and the older sibling's care before they're a certain age, because even though they really did start out watching the younger, they forget. And they get distracted very easily, and they go to all other sorts of things. So they forgot that clothing's on the floor. So a reminder of clothing is still on the floor comes off much less offensive than telling them what to do. Or giving information. This you'll hear. Anyone who you hear is feeling like, you know, walls are not for writing. That's a person who's read this book. When you hear that kind of language, my hands are not for hitting. Walls are not for writing. That's the kind of language. No, in terms of, as opposed to, we don't write on walls. That's a much more attacking kind of language, as opposed to just, walls are not for writing. Here's a washcloth, and you could fill that out. No, you like
that? That doesn't work in my family. My mom doesn't have
that. She doesn't write. That would be a bad example, right? That would be a bad example, for sure. Filling a page, just one more little... on the page right before the problem solving, just two last things on this one. Again, just saying it with the word is the same basic idea, you know, like your lunch, as opposed to, you know, giving them a whole dialogue as to that they forgot their lunch, just simply letting them know with a word. And lastly, this is an important one, the last one on that page, talk about your feelings. This is a very important one, because this is like all the time. You're in the store, and your child starts pulling on your sleeve, pulling on your leg, or hits you in public. How do you respond to those kinds of episodes, in a way? So you speak about your feelings on the matter. You know, I don't like having my sleeve pulled. It's much less offensive, and as a child needs to be told, I'm online, I'm trying to deal with the cashier, and someone's pulling on your sleeve, I don't like having my sleeve pulled. Is a thing that needs to be said, but doesn't come off the way that it otherwise could under that kind of circumstance where you're trying to tell the children what they can or can't do that. And as your children get older, this will be a tool which you'll get more and more used to, because they'll be doing more and more things. What you're just saying, I don't like it. It bothers me when you speak like that. It bothers me when you do this. It hurts me. So it's coming from my end. as opposed to describing the child again from the things that they are or they are not doing. Yeah. Okay, am I moving too fast? Is this like too much information?
No.
Or it's obvious? It's okay?
No, it's fine.
Yeah? Okay, problem solving. This is a great one for when you really get stuck. You know, you're not really sure what to do. I had a situation where we were discussing this. A parent was telling me that they were trying to toilet train the younger child, and the older child was just causing a ruckus when they were trying to do that, either making a mess in the bathroom, or if the mother would be in the bathroom with the younger child, then the older child would just, like, it was freedom outside and would make a mess or would be taking food. And she couldn't figure out a way, because if she took the older child with her into the bathroom, he would just distract and ruin the whole process for the younger child. And if she left him out, he would ruin the house, and she was home alone, and she, like, wasn't sure what to do. So we tried a bunch of love and lodgings, and, like, nothing was working. So we tried this, and it worked with great success. You, at the steps on the bottom of page 102 there on the side, you actually sit down with your child, and any child who's old enough to cause these kinds of problems, old enough to do this, and you describe, you could actually take out a piece of paper, and you sit down and you say, okay, this is the problem. I have to toilet train your younger sister, and you really want to be able to play outside. I have a problem because when you play outside, then the house gets a mess. Or if I keep you inside, there's a problem. What should we do about this? Like, how should we solve this problem? You actually sit down with a pencil and you throw out every possible suggestion, even the ones that you know and he knows are never going to be a possibility, but you put them all on paper. And you take turns, like, giving suggestions. How about we stop toilet training so-and-so? That's a good idea. Let's put that down on the table. That's an option. We'll stop the whole process. How about you get to run around and do whatever you want? Okay, that's a good option. You run around. I won't, you know, I'll pay attention to the little one. You do whatever you want. You come up with all different solutions. And then you go back over them and see whether or not it will work. In the sense of, well, can we stop, you know, that one's not going to work, and that one's not going to work, until you actually come to a solution that the child feels heard in their sense as to what it is that they need to do. The example that they bring here, if that wasn't a clear example, was, you know, a child who was having trouble leaving, you know, a friend's house when they're in the middle of doing something and it's time to get picked up. So the mother sits down and says, you know, I know that this is a trouble that you're having. And on the other hand, I'm having trouble because if you don't come home on time, I worry about you. You know, what do you think? Did I miss a page? I did. Notice I have upside down. Yeah. So, you know, what do you think we should do that we can come up with a plan where you can stay and have a good time and I don't have to worry about you? And you come up with a bunch of different solutions and you work it out. This works really well because children are creative. And if we'll give them the opportunity to be heard as to the reason why they're coming home late or the reason why they don't want to do this is because they really want to do something else, and you'll sit down and give them that opportunity to problem solve, you'd be amazed as to the creativity that your 4, 5, and certainly older than that child can come up with if you sit down with them and give them the opportunity to figure out what are some possible solutions. Mommy's having a real hard time getting out of the house in the morning. It's taking a long time to eat breakfast and get dressed, and we're always late. What do you think we should do about this? And you obviously have in mind what you want to have in mind, whether or not it's leaving clothing out for them that wasn't working, or having breakfast poured. Figuring out a way, let the child on his own be in control of the problem. What do we need to do that you should be able to play your computer game or do whatever it is that he's being distracted by in the morning, but yet still, until he comes to the conclusion of, oh, I know, how about if I only play on the game until after I'm already dressed? Oh. Now, you might have had to come up with a bunch of other suggestions, and he'll come up with a bunch until you got to that. But when he's the one who thinks of the solution, as opposed to you, it will be far more successful, even though that was a very obvious solution of we just play games after we're dressed as opposed to before. But when you present it as, I'm having this problem, it's taking us a long time, what do you think we should do about it? Dialogue until he feels it's his idea, you will find that to be a great tool. Okay, one last one and we'll let you go. Encouraging on time. Again, I'm running through these quickly. I hope it's coming out clear, but again, just read through the packet, read through the books, you'll find it all here, but this is just to whet your appetite. Let your children make choices has a lot to do with love and logic. We did that already, so I'm going to skip to the next one. Show respect for a child's struggle. This one is so, so important. I feel like I said that about all of them, but it's true. We so quickly jump in and solve our children's problems for them. Let them struggle with whatever it is that they're struggling with. In the case of a camel, he's trying to open up a jar. And we're so fast to reach in and say, oh, here, let me do that for you. Let the child do it. Let the child become autonomous. Let the child become their own person, being able to figure it out, whether or not it's, you know, tying their shoes, working on their problems, cleaning up a mess, taking a bath, getting dressed. You know, you have a child who's learning to get dressed on their own, and they, you know, they come in and they have everything done except their socks. Instead of responding with, you didn't finish your socks and shoes yet, or let me do your socks for you, acknowledging what it is that then you did it all. All you have left is your socks. Do you need help? Are you ready to go? But allowing them to struggle with whatever that they're doing so that they can come up with it on their own, as opposed to taking it from them. You have the not asking too many questions. Oh, I lost the showman. Oh, no. It's 9:28. I thought I had till 9:30 before I would lose you. You're doing the work for them?
I hope not.
I don't like that. Okay, so the last one that I'll mention, you can read this all on your own. The last one that I want to mention is the taking away hope, and the very last thing. You know, very often, you know, our children will say things at a young age. You know, I want to be a baseball player. Now, every Jewish parent knows that their child is just not going to be. There are 1,000 obstacles. But when you're dealing with a 6-year-old who's gotten excited about the sport, there's no reason to crush that. When he's 6, kid wants to play baseball. Great. So you want to play baseball? Amazing. You want to go out and practice? You want to be on a team? Let them have that, as opposed to as a 6-year-old saying, oh, you'll never be able to do that. It's impossible with Shabbos and the college and this. You know, he'll grow out of it. By the time he hits 9, he'll want to be a football player, and then it's fine, and then he'll grow out of that, and he'll eventually want to be a doctor, and everything will be fine. You don't have to worry. You don't need to push him down in the beginning, whatever it is that they want to do. If they want to do that, you know, there's no reason to, now again, unless you have specific hopes and dreams, but even so, like, they'll grow out of most of the things without us having, taking away their hopes and their dreams. But those are just some tools. I wanted to all get it in, so I said it was going to be 3 weeks. We'll get it all into 3. I ran through these last things very, very quickly, but this packet is worth reading and rereading, because you'll see the way that we interact with our kids. If you're good with the praise, unconditional love, you fill them with that, the entire home environment changes. If you successfully do these things, in which you respond to your children's feelings without denying them, without not allowing them to feel what it is that they feel, just acknowledging them and working it through, you will find the love and logic part of the first two sessions that we had much more successful, because the environment is totally different. It's not a constant battle. Things are generally very positive and warm in the home, so that when corrections need to be made, and they're made in a either love and logic way or whatever way that they're going to be said, the overall environment is such where it's so filled with positive comments and positive feelings through all of these different little techniques that everything works much, much better through that. All right, I hope this wasn't too fast. Questions, comments, yeah?
I do have a question, because it's actually something that comes up with love and logic and with this, is when you give them choices.
Yeah.
What do? When you give them their 2 choices and they come up with a 3rd? And to the point that you've said, well, you know, that's not an option, these are your 2 choices, and they turn that back around on you.
Okay, so...
You know, and you know, so that, well, gets, that you give them the 2 options, and they say, no, those aren't my choices. My choices are... And,
okay, that gets back to enforceable choices, where the choices that you've offered are both enforceable, something that you can control, and then you can say, in other words, would you like to choose, or do you want me to choose for you? So he says, I want the 3rd option. That was the one of your choices. It sounds like you want me to choose. And then he'll say the 3rd option again, and then you choose. And again, if your choices were good, and that they were both enforceable choices that you can live with, then you make the choice. It has to be enforceable. In other words, if one of the options is something you can't do, and now you're stuck with these 2 choices, then you really lost that battle when you gave the choices, because you couldn't really hold to them. But if your choices are good choices, you want to come up with an example, which just makes, you know, we test it out. But if it's
the example of, I don't know, which pair of pants you should wear in the morning. Let him pick his clothes. So here's 2 pairs of pants. These are the choices I've given him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I pulled out of the drawer, and he said, no, I don't want any of those. I'm not getting dressed. I'm staying in my pajamas today, and we discussed that. I'm not, you know. At that point, his pajama pants are off. He wants to go to school in his underwear. It's 30 degrees. It's not happening. So at that point, you know, his choice is, you know, his third option
mm-hmm.
is, you know, he doesn't want to wear any pants.
Right.
I'm saying, well, you don't really have a choice. You know, which pair of pants do you want? So I can enforce it, but it's literally a physical battle of putting the pants on him.
Right, which is what you don't want to engage in. Right. Right. Because
so
right.
Where's, you know, at that point, do I send him back to the dresser
and see if I can come up with something?
You know, send him to his dresser and he gets to pick a pair of pants from it. But there's more.
So no, that would be the problem solving. That would be a problem solving, which you could sit down the night before and say, "Was Yehuda?
Yeah.
Yehuda Tzvi, right? Got the whole thing. Say, we're having a problem in the mornings because mommy needs to get you dressed and you don't like to get dressed. That's not an option. What should we do? What do you think?" And then let's see where that one goes in the sense of whether or not he'll come up with, oh, I want to go to school in my... Is pajamas an option for you?
Not so much.
Not an option. Okay.
And,
so
and this time of year it's too cold. His pajamas aren't particularly warm. So I just...
So in other words, I mean,
pajamas,
yeah.
Right.
No, but, and if that's an option... No, then you don't want to get in this fight. No, that's the kind of fight where, like, to me, like, not worth fighting. He's going to go out of that. Not going to want to go to school in his pajamas for very long. So if it's an option of buying longer pajamas, so I would do that. Would you like to go to school in your pajamas, or do you want to get dressed? I don't know of many children who will hit a certain age, and he's probably just about there, where going to school in pajamas is not going to be so fun. If you wanted to get his teacher in cahoots with you, they can say, you know, children who are dressed get to play with the toys. You're welcome to, you know, you could be here, but this is the chair, the table where children sit in pajamas because the rest of it are for children who are dressed. If she's interested and willing to do that, I don't know, wherever he's going, yes or no. Or if you're just willing to have him in pajamas, I don't think it'll last all that long. So then give him an option where that, you know, that's, again, I'm just throwing out a suggestion if that works for you or not. Get him a pair of warmer pajamas that you're comfortable sending him to school with. And then it's a matter of sitting down with him and saying, this is the problem we're having. How do you want to handle it? I want to go to school in pajamas. You know, if you're okay with that. I don't know. To me, I don't have a problem sending my kids to school in pajamas because it's something that they're going to grow out of. So it's not a battle to me worth fighting. If you wanted to buy him, like, if you really wanted to manipulate it, you can get him, like, pink pajamas. That'll last even, that'll go a lot shorter than if you get him, like, cool Spider-Man pajamas where he might actually want to go to school in them.
What's his role? Like, this morning, my son, his pajamas actually looked like clothing a little bit, so I didn't care so much today. But he said, I want to wear my pajamas. So I said, okay, here's your clothing, whatever you want to do, I don't care for your pajamas. And he, like, couldn't believe I said that, and I didn't care if he wore his pajamas, because it was like clothing, kind of, and I came back to his dress. I couldn't believe it. I was like, okay, I would have totally said him in his pajamas, but he couldn't believe I said okay to it.
Right.
That he didn't really
want to
go
into dominance. So a lot of it is this power struggle, and our kids are always, like, because they're worth keeping, are always looking for areas to keep their control, so getting dressed is one of them. So when you give it back to them and say, I'm not going to fight you on this one, all right, so how will he really always want to go to school in pajamas? So to me, that's a battle not worth fighting. So get him pajamas you're comfortable sending him in. And that's what I would do. I'm not the expert, that's just what I would do. I wouldn't fight that battle. You'll have others.
I mean, that was just an example, but I mean,
yeah.
he tends to throw out his choice. You know,
right, what really happened, just as an example, is you threw out two choices which you really weren't able to enforce because you have two choices of pants, and you're not in a position to enforce the option of, I don't want either one of these, because you can't force him into pants. So in other words, his third option trumps yours because I can't actually force you to say, for me, to I really what should happen is that I'll choose. Let's say you would have said, do you want to go to school in pajamas, or do you want to go to school in pants? And he says, I don't want to go to school in pants at all. Neither. I'm taking off my pants and I'm going in my underwear. So it's hard to get him. I mean, he might, right? So if you could at least keep him in his pajamas, which he's wearing, I mean, that's a hard, but if one of the choices is one where you can choose and do it, so then, but you can't enforce him to put on his pants.
Does he want to completely choose a pair of pants by himself at that point? Like I'm saying, is he like, no, I want to choose a pair of pants, or does he only want to go in his underwear?
Usually that's the resolution, is he ends up choosing his pair of pants.
My sister does, which is definitely adds a lot of work, let's say in the evening or whenever she's finished with the laundry, is she splits up all the kids' clothes into pairs, and she puts them all in a gallon Ziploc, meaning there's a pair of underwear, socks, pants, and a shirt in a Ziploc, and the kids can go choose anything they want from that.
Wow.
Or it's just a matter of, you know, a matter of having him choose it the night before.
Right.
It's
an hour of fighting in the morning.
Oh, you're going in pajamas. It's an hour of
at the fact work. I mean, but it's quiet work. She can do what she wants on TV or whatever.
I would problem solve with him. Like, sit, have him come up with the solution and see whether or not he says, I want to pick it out from scratch or I want to pick it out the night before. That's what I let him see what he wants to do. All right, everyone, thanks for coming. I hope you enjoyed and got something out of it. I highly recommend all these books, as I've mentioned many times. Read them. It's a great investment in your family.
This is why I need
and your sanity.